What's happening, everybody? Thanks for tuning in to the Crash Bang Boom podcast, episode 280 with drummer, producer, engineer, and more, Matt Guglielmo. I'm on a roll here with talking to studio owners who double as studio and touring drummers, if you haven't noticed. Matt and I talk about the differences in playing with End versus the Acacia Strain, the flood that affected his previous studio and found them relocated to a cabin in the woods of New Jersey with producer Will Putney, as well as the general evolution of working in studios and ironing out one's drumming from recordings. So I hope y'all enjoy the convo. Today's episode is sponsored by OneUpLoops.com. Drummer Carson Gann and his team spent an incredible amount of time recording over 430,000 shaker, tambourine, and hi-hat loops at every possible tempo in multiple feels with incredible mics and outboard gear for you to pick and choose. It's organized for you to find exactly what you need with just a few clicks and everything feels and sounds incredible. You can sign up for free to check it out and gain full access to all 430,000 loops starting at just $6 a month. No download limits, whatever you want, whenever you want. New loops, one-shots, and drum breaks are being added weekly. Definitely a great addition to the arsenal of any drummer and or producer looking for an alternative to standard click tracks by getting swung shaker patterns and one drops and everything else. So check it out. It's OneUpLoops.com. Crash Bang Boom podcast can be found where all podcasts are found, including Spotify, iTunes, Stitcher, and YouTube, to name a few. If you like what you hear, please check out any of the previous 280-plus episodes and give me a like and or a subscription or even a positive review. It would be appreciated. All right, let's dive into it. Matt Guglielmo, Crash Bang Boom.
Crowds go mad with joy.
Yes! All right, I'm here with Matt Guglielmo. Guglielmo, I'm trying to get as Italian as I can, trying to be someone out of The Sopranos as best I can, being a non-Italian American myself.
Yes, sir.
How's it going, dude?
What's up, man? I'm good. How are you?
Pretty good, man. It's been a long time, dude. We were initially messaging each other. I was saying that I think one of the last times that I saw you live, and you've done it so much since then, was when your band Circuitry played with one of my two bands in Brooklyn, either Family or Beast Modulus, at St. Vitus. And I mean, I think to your point, I do believe that that was maybe a decade ago. Does that sound about right?
It had to have been 10 years ago, easily. Because that was like, I think that was around when Circuitry started.
Yeah.
And we were just kind of trying to do as much as possible. So yeah, it had to be like 2013, 2014. And I believe that show was with the band Binary Code.
It was. You're right.
Yes.
Absolutely. There it is.
Very cool band from back in the day.
Yes, yes. Jesse is a bud of mine. I think he's out in Colorado now doing like game soundtracks or something. He's on a whole nother wild path, the guitarist of that band. It's wild.
Yeah, I remember seeing on his profile he was doing like something with Marvel or something. Yeah. Nice dude. Cool guy.
Absolutely, man. Well, starting out, I feel like, one, when I saw y'all, I was like, damn, this guy can shred on the drums. And also, I feel like you were kind of dabbling or gearing yourself towards producing. I don't know if I talked to you that night or not, but I had a sense that you had something to do with production and audio recording, et cetera. But damn, dude, I mean, I guess it's a pretty broad question, but over the last 10 years, I mean, I've talked to quite a few producers, and it seems like it always started out with some sort of semi-archaic recording device that then evolved into a whole room full of gear and fucking recording people. I'm assuming, has that been your deal?
Yeah, more or less. I mean, so I feel like I've always kind of been like juggling the two. Like mm-hmm. I'd always been playing drums and trying to record and produce
yeah.
at the same time. And that's kind of like what my life has become now. Nothing's really changed since then. But trying to recall like back to that specific time, yeah, it had to have been like the baby steps uh-huh. that I was taking towards like trying to be a producer. And I remember that Circuitry record, like our first record that we had, was like the first thing that I like had engineered. It sounds terrible.
Uh-huh.
you could tell it's like one of the first things that I've done. But yeah, I mean, since then, I want to say that was definitely one of the first things that I had attempted to bring to life as my career as a producer.
Right. Where are you located now, and sort of what's your setup with your studio?
I am in Newton, New Jersey, which is, if you look at a map of New Jersey, it's like the northwest tip there. Like, I call it upstate New Jersey because it's like in the middle of the mountains, in the middle of the woods.
Awesome.
The studio that we have now is a log cabin. And
amazing.
My room that I'm in right now is like a barn detached from the cabin that I like turned into my mix room.
That's awesome. So you've got a little mix room, control room. I see guitar rigs and everything, so you can record everything. I guess, is there a separate live room for drums and everything else? And then you just pipe in from there if that's the case?
Yep, exactly. So yeah, this room is just for like mixing, tracking guitars, tracking vocals. And then inside the cabin is where drums happen. I've posted pictures on my Instagram if anyone's interested in seeing what that looks like.
Oh yeah, man.
Yeah, nice log cabin, secluded. It's where we moved after our last studio flooded. That was kind of like the whole catalyst for moving and getting this house was because our last studio, like the downstairs, completely flooded.
What space was this that flooded?
This was this is the Belleville spot. Like was known at one point as the machine shop, was Will's studio for years.
Oh damn, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, me and Randy LaBeouf had taken it over after like Will moved out, and then a year or two into that, the downstairs flooded, and Will, because he was still using that space as his drum room, was like, I'm out of a drum room now. So,
oh shit.
So it looks like it's time to, you know, figure something else out. So we got this log cabin, turned that into the drum room. There's like, you know, rooms in there for like the bands to stay and all that, and like a kitchen and the whole control room and everything.
Awesome.
So yeah, that's really that's the new spot, man.
Did y'all lose a lot of gear in the flood?
No, we actually, I think the only thing we lost was like Randy's computer.
Ooh.
Which, considering, because it was his room that that flooded mostly. It was like all of his like amps, and I was afraid he lost records at first, because he had where it had downpoured like from his ceiling, it had rained directly or flooded directly onto his hard drives.
Oh no, fuck.
And I was like fuck, man, I really hope really hope you have backups and you didn't just lose like three records worth of tracks and stuff. But
oh, God.
Yeah, luckily we had, I was recording a band called Degrader, and he was recording Orthodox, and they had both had happened to be there as exactly as it was happening. So mm-hmm. We caught it.
Wow.
And literally both bands, like we just round up everyone and like we're just running gear upstairs because it was flooding like on the first level, not the second level. So we were like running cabs and amps and everything like upstairs as fast as we could to like save everything. We save everything except his computer.
Wow.
Which even then, I got his computer to a point where it turns on, but it's just kind of fucked.
Yeah, I bet it is.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Okay, so now I'm sort of realizing the Will Putney connection, it sounds like. And I was looking on your website for some of your credits and whatnot. You played drums on one of the Fit for an Autopsy records?
I did. The last record, Oh, What the Future Holds, is the one I played drums on. That's because Hosian, their regular drummer, who's also awesome, he was getting double knee replacement surgery.
Oh Jesus.
Yeah, hit something, I honestly don't know exactly why, like something with his knees were shot to where he needed both of them fully replaced, and obviously you can't play drums.
Not
when
so
that's
much.
The case.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I did that one because he was unable.
Got you. I also saw, did you play drums on a Fuming Mouth record?
The Beyond the Tomb, the EP that they did. It was that EP and then like two singles after that that were out like last year, 2 years ago.
Gotcha. How was that running their material?
It's awesome. So, yeah, the EP I had actually gone to God City to record.
Oh, sweet.
And Kurt Blue ended up mixing it, but I worked with Zach Weeks, who's like his assistant, and he does a bunch of shit on his own.
Nice.
Zach's awesome. And yeah, working there was rad. That's like one of my favorite drum sounds.
Consistently, he gets, it's insane.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I remember that was the first time I had played a Ludwig Classic Maple too.
Mm-hmm.
And it just, like, it made me fall in love with Ludwigs. I'd never cared about Ludwig, not because I thought they were bad or anything. I just never had any sort of like affiliation or experience with Ludwig. But as soon as I played that kid, I was like, wow, this like just feels amazing. And the drum sound on that EP really like reflects that. And yeah, because of that, it was like one of my favorites that that I've done in terms of like actual drum sounds.
Wow, man. So Will Putney is a sort of common thread between End and Fit for an Autopsy, being a sought after producer as well. What are some of your takeaways in working with him, be it sort of on the engineering side, interacting with him, and or just as a drummer, you working on recordings that maybe he's producing?
Well, I'll put it to you this way. Like, my workflow is basically like this, the same, like how I go about making records and like how I navigate Logic and like prep records to like be mixed and whatnot. Like all of that's based off of like his workflow. And to a degree, like his workflow is based off of when he used to be Machine's intern. So that kind of all trickled down and I've developed like that same order of operations when I like record pretty much anything. So it really has molded like who I am as a producer.
Yeah.
And it kind of gave me an identity in a way and like some direction as to, cause other than interning for him, you know, 6-7 years ago, like whatever it is at this point, mm-hmm. I haven't really had any like professional, like education or training
on like the audio engineering side. Yeah.
Yeah, I had attempted to go to school for that sort of thing, and it didn't quite work out. I was by the school. I was like promised certain positions in like audio programs that were, I ended up realizing were just like lies to keep me enrolled. So I never got like, I never got like a proper education on recording. So upon interning for him, and like obviously, you know, getting help from Randy and Steve, his assistant, and another dude, Ryan Latrue, used to play in Four Today. Like they all really like helped guide me. And I mean, without the four of them, like, I don't know that I would really know what I would be doing mm-hmm. right now in terms of like, just from an engineering standpoint and like having a good solid workflow that's like based off of all of their workflows. So
yeah.
Oh, I really owe it to them, all the four of them, to have given me some sort of direction over the years. Yeah.
Totally, totally. And there's something to be said. I mean, I have this kind of studio that I work in down here, just tracking drums for my own projects, and just sort of stumbling my way through the dark, so to speak, with that and collecting gear over the years. But it has changed the way that I sort of perceive the drum parts that I orchestrate or ultimately play and or record, in that I sort of have a little bit of a producer ear now, whereas I didn't have that. So it has changed my playing. I imagine, especially with as long as you've been doing it, have you kind of experienced something similar in that fashion?
Oh, dude, absolutely. One hand washes the other with producing and drumming.
Yeah.
100%. Seeing your drums under the microscope that is recording.
Yeah.
Is such a big thing. And I encourage anyone, young drummer or like seasoned vet, to like record yourself playing and dissect it, because I think it was through that is what made me realize my weaknesses.
Mm-hmm.
And through doing that over and over again, that's how you get better, is like figuring out where your weak points are, pinpointing those and working on them. So like if I'm recording myself, if I realize, you know, oh, every time like I hit like a left crash, like my kick comes in early, I could see that on a grid.
Right.
And now I know that, okay, that's something to work on. And just like from hearing it back and you know, over analyzing every bit of what you record, which is just what my job is most of the time anyway.
Yeah.
Through doing that, that's how you get better. You become a more precise, solid player.
Right. I feel like my Achilles heel has been and still is double bass playing and recording it. And if I'm not using, I don't use triggers or anything. So, you know, the difference in volume, if you're using a double pedal on a single drum, you know, I've just, I was literally before we sat down today, I was trying to record one last part for the song that I'm recording. And it's something that I feel like you could play in your sleep. I literally, and then I was like, Matt could play this in his sleep. Then it was in my head. Then I was like, I fucking suck with this double bass shit. And it was just pissing me off. And then it just got worse. So I just had to stop. But double bass has been the one for me that is just like every time I record it, I'm like, God damn it.
Yeah, it sucks. It fully sucks. But once you get it, it's cool. And that's actually a perfect example because, you know, you go to record something like that and you notice you could see, oh, like my left foot is a little bit lower in volume. It's not quite as powerful as my right foot. Okay, that's something to work on. Either, you know, just work on left foot techniques or just, you know, adjust your pedal accordingly to like whatever you have to do. But through recording and seeing that on the grid, it's a great thing that we're able to do that because it's not something I had when I was younger. It was only something I was able to really figure out like later in my, like the second half of my drumming career.
Right. I mean, unless you're Daniel Day-Lewis writing with your feet in My Left Foot, the movie, none of us are really writing with our feet. So you're asking your feet to do something, you know, pretty specific and in time. And then with double bass, I do feel like there are more variables in that. Like it could be chain tension or spring tension. It could be the angle of the beater. It could definitely be your posture. It could be how far you sit back or how far you sit forward. It could be that you need to sit a little bit more to the left or be more centered with it.
Could be anything.
It could be so much shit that it can really take you a long time to figure out what is going on.
Exactly.
It's a pain, dude.
Yep. Oh yeah, it's terrible. It's the worst, but it sounds cool. Yeah. So
you seem like you have really good double bass. You've had double bass. You must have gone through a period in your life. Did you start playing double bass early when you were playing drums? You sound like you might have.
Like a year in.
Okay.
Yeah. Like my cousin, who's like the reason that I started playing drums. Like my cousin was a drummer in like a punk band growing up, and he's like who made me want to play drums. And I think like a year after I started playing, he got me a set of DW 5000s. And I was just like, I just like figured it out kind of. Like I didn't have, because any drum instructor that I was going to at the time, like any lessons that I was taking, like no one was really like teaching me double bass stuff. Because like that just, there were no schools that were like, they wanted to teach me like rudiments and like, you know, the Carmine Appice like rock book thing,
right?
Which is like what every beginning drummer like has to go through.
Mm-hmm.
As far as the double kick shit goes, I more or less like had to teach myself and like figure out how to do that on my own. That's like 20 years ago at this point, so I've been used to double kicks like for the better half of 20 years easily.
That's awesome. I'm on the other end of the spectrum where I've been playing over 30 years and I waited about 20 years to start it. And I think at that point, the way that I sat and my, you know, my distance from the kit, the ergonomically, the setup of it all that kind of had to change. I took a lesson with Ken Schalk of Canderia that I've talked about before. And he was like, he said, all right, dude, no. Like, first of all, he broke everything down. He was like, put the bass drum at 1 o'clock. Imagine that you're playing two bass drums. So you're sitting central to it and your feet are evenly spaced from your hips. I was sitting kind of cockeyed and then my left foot was fucked up. He's like, all right, we got it. And meanwhile, I was thinking he was going to show me like cool Canderia drum beats. And meanwhile, he's breaking my kit down and telling me that I look fucking ridiculous the way that I'm playing. I'm like, you son of a bitch. But he was right in that regard.
I'm sure there's some truth to that. And yeah, there's a lot to be said about like posture and cymbal height and seat height. And like, I mean, could talk hours about, you know, just the different ergonomic setups that you can do. And just, yeah, I mean, honestly, I don't know that there's a correct answer with all that.
Everybody's body is different. Whatever works.
Exactly. Whatever doesn't hurt your body and whatever makes you play better. I feel like that's the correct answer. As long as you're not hurting yourself and you're playing better, that's the correct setup.
Right. Crazy, man. So between End and Acacia Strain, I think I said it right, there are some similarities in style, both with being sort of, I might consider it like Northeast Coast sort of deathcore or whatever, you know, if you want to call it that, whatever subgenre you want to attach to it. But it's certainly heavy, and there are moments of like hardcore and like borderline death metal and shit like that, hence the, I guess, deathcore thing. But what were some of the challenges in learning the back catalog of both of those bands, and sort of how did they differ between each other? I know that that's kind of an extensive question as well.
It's funny because there is like the tiniest crossover point between the two bands.
Uh-huh.
Like, but they really are like entirely different monsters altogether.
Hmm.
Acacia Strain stuff. So I filled in for them for the first time in 2018, I want to say.
Okay.
So, you know, joining the band now, like, I already know their entire catalog.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, rewinding to that time, that was, like, my first pretty big fill-in opportunity.
Yeah.
And so, for me, like, I just remember really shedding the shit out of all of those songs. And, like, not that any of them were, like, particularly difficult. They're not on the technical side that the new end stuff is. So learning right. Acacia Strain songs it's more groove oriented. They're a lot slower. They're mm-hmm. not as like mathy. There's some like mathy bits on the two newest records,
mm-hmm.
which is why I say there is like a little bit of a crossover now.
Gotcha.
But as far as older Acacia Strain stuff, it is more groove oriented, slower, like more like rhythmic patterns, not as much, not any blast beats at all. If I really think about it, like, I feel like the first Acacia Strain blast beats were like this record, you know, that like the band never had any like super crazy fast stuff like that until now.
Uh-huh.
Which is cool. I enjoy playing that stuff, but,
yeah.
So yeah, Acacia Strain's not as stressful to play. You know, that sets all on a click. It is definitely easier, and it's just nonstop chaos for 30 to 45 minutes. Like I'm there's no click. I'm blast beating from the second we start the set to the end, more or less. So yeah, one is significantly harder, and one is one is enjoyable. No, that's not true. no, yeah, they're just different beasts altogether. Each band comes with their own challenges.
Gotcha. Yeah, I mean, certainly there's always that vocabulary that Billy Reimer got, formerly who was in End, and obviously Dillinger Escape Plan. And I mean, that kind of leads me to the question of sometimes I feel like the musical language that Dillinger developed is something, and I talk about it a good bit, but I feel like bands today frequently quote it to the extent that sometimes I'm wondering if they even know that the origins came from there. Whereas, you know, when I first saw them open up for Mr. Bungle, I was definitely like, what the fuck is that? You know, there was definitely not anyone playing that. That vocabulary didn't happen prior to them, you know. But now it's certainly a more common thing. But where do you sort of see the drumming style of like Chris Penny sort of as being an influence up to today and in today's sort of heavier music?
Oh, man. I mean, I can only speak on how him and that band have influenced me. They definitely put like mathy progressive music on the map. Like, I think... Yeah. I think in terms of that genre, I mean, I'll put them with neck and neck with Converge, but
sure.
Dillinger for me anyway was like is my favorite band to ever do any of that stuff, and for sure like Pioneers easily like in my opinion the best to ever do it,
yeah,
hands down,
yeah,
and I mean they influence like generations of musicians to come with that stuff.
Yes.
Like there was nothing, you need to think back to like when they came out, there was nothing like it at the time.
Absolutely.
Like when Calculating Infinity came out, there was absolutely nothing like they invented a fucking genre. They
totally.
Just, they were just like, we want music that sounds like this. So we're going to make it. And now here you go. It exists.
Yeah.
It's pretty fucking crazy to think about.
Totally.
because they'd have, I don't think they started the band with that intention. Like, hey, we're going to create a genre. It was just like, this is what we like. This is, and I'm speaking for them. I'm speculating here, but they definitely just started the band out of love. That's just what they wanted to hear. So they made that music. And I think that in and of itself is just as influential, like that aspect of just creating something because that's what you want to hear, and just because you want to do it and you want to make music like this. I think that's as important as like the actual music that they wrote themselves. I feel like that mindset's been kind of lost, and I hate to sound like an old man who's like, oh, right. back in my day things were, but no, but really I feel like more people should go into creating with that mindset, because look what they did. Look what they achieved and accomplished with creating music in that way. They created, you know, this amazing legacy, and they're like one of the best. I think they're the best live band I've ever seen in my life.
I think I saw them, if I've counted right, I think 15 times.
Wow.
I've never seen a band more than them. So yeah, you're preaching to the choir on that one. I've always been blown away by what they're doing. And I mean, to your point, they created what they created. They stayed true to what they were doing. They never compromised on it. And they always had like unmatched energy on the stage. So it's just like, and they did it for like 20 years, which seems fucking physically impossible. I'm amazed Ben is still out there playing with Suicidal Tendencies. I feel like he should just be a crippled old man. He's just made of some other, like, otherworldly material, that fucking guy.
The man has put himself through more than enough over the years. And, you know, I respect the shit out of that.
Yeah, totally.
But, yeah, so to me, that band, that Billy is like, is the guy for that band for me. And I guess part of that is because I didn't see them until like 2010 or 11, like after he had joined the band. So I'd only seen them with him, not to discredit anyone, you know, Gil and
of course
Chris, by any means, cause they're so goddamn good. But
yeah, for real.
Yeah. Billy, for me, it was just always like, oh, this is the guy meant for that band. Like, he was just blew me away from day one.
Yeah.
I remember seeing them at, was it Irving Plaza? Yeah, Greg put his boot in my face. I got a nice footprint right on my right on my face because he jumped off the balcony. But that was easily one of the craziest shows I've ever seen in my life. Like, that was
absolutely
the experiences at Dillinger shows are like no other. And I feel bad for anyone who hasn't gotten to experience that in the past and might never get to.
I hear you, man. What do your parents make of this music that you both play and produce? What do they think about it?
Well, I can't say that they are fans of heavy music in general. However, I think they respect how far I've gotten over the years and that I'm able to like pay my bills with it. They just want me to make money. I think that's really what it comes down to. As long as I'm making some sort of money, I think they're happy. But yeah, I mean, growing up, they were just like, are you sure about this? Like, are you sure you can make a living on this? I was like, I'll figure it out. I'm pretty sure I can.
Yeah.
I didn't know that for sure. I had no idea if it was actually going to happen or not. But
of course.
Yeah, I don't know. I just figured it out. I just kind of lied to them and told them it was going to be okay until it finally was. So
with circuitry, I feel like I mentioned earlier that there's so much shredding. I kind of figured that band, because it covers so much territory and has so much going on, that it would prepare you to play like in any of these other bands. But it sounds like every band has its own little challenges, despite the fact that, you know, like I said, in circuitry, I feel like you cover so much territory and there's so much shredding, but there's always some sort of different challenge, I guess, with playing these other parts in these other bands, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, circuitry was proggy in the sense to where, like, we had, like, some of it was fast and some of it was like, oh, you got an odd time thing here and there. And it's just, yeah, some of it could be like a little odd for sure. But I don't think any of that stuff holds a candle to new end material.
Yeah.
It's so off the rails. And that was all written before I was on board at all. So it was actually written with Billy in mind. Like, it was written with, I don't know how much, I actually don't know how much writing he did on the drum parts in general. It might just be all Will and Greg, but
his level of energy in mind as a fucking Energizer bunny, right?
Yeah. It was written for a drumming psychopath.
Right.
He ended up just being too busy, didn't work out with him. And like, as they were going to record this record, The Sin of Human Frailty, they hit me up and were like, hey, do you want to do this? Like, do you just, cause I had been filling in the past year cause he's been busy with like horror and thought crimes and you know, whatever else he had going on. And
yeah,
so I was filling in a lot last year. And then at the end of last year, when we were about to track drums, they were like, do you want to do this? I was like, yeah, okay. And I just, having not heard the material, they're like, okay, we're going to send you the Dropbox link. And I listened to it and I was like, Jesus fucking Christ, man.
That's awesome.
Yeah, definitely. It kicked my ass. I learned all of that record in my garage on pads, like not like rubber pads. Like, it was my kit and I like towels on my cymbals and like rubber pads on the drums.
Right.
That's how I learned that whole record. And it took me like a month and a half. I feel like it was like January to mid or be, yeah, about a month and some change to fully learn that record and like have it down.
Damn.
Yeah.
And that record being The Sin of Human Frailty, right?
Yeah.
Right on. Crazy town. That shit is intense, man.
Yeah. Cause I never really considered myself like a crazy drummer. That was like never my intention, like upon playing drums. Like, I just wanted to create, really. I just wanted to like make cool stuff, and whether it was crazy or not, that was another conversation. But this record kind of forced me to adopt this new style of playing where it's like half psycho, like really jarring fast stuff, and then half like caveman, you know, breakdown sort of stuff.
Right.
And yeah, I'm thankful to be a part of this record specifically because of all of this new territory that it threw me into. Like all these this new style of playing that I'm not really accustomed to yet. You know, I kind of just was thrown into the deep end. It was like, okay, you got a month to figure out how to do all of this.
Jesus.
And it worked. It works live. Which that was like another thing I was worried about. I was like, can all this be pulled off live?
Actually executed live?
Yeah, I actually didn't know upon recording the record. I was like, I don't know if I can like actually get through all this, but I was just like, you better fucking figure it out, man. you don't have that much time, but you better figure it out. And
wow.
And we did. And this last tour that we did with Full of Hell, playing all the new stuff, not all the new stuff, but a good chunk of it. It was really fun. It was awesome. Yeah.
Badass. So here's a question for you. With all the heavy music that you both produce, play on, the bands that you play in, et cetera, are there any like heavy bands out there, or, you know, whatever subgenre thereof, that you've been digging as of late?
Oh, man. It's always so hard for me to like think and sift through all of the bands that I have been listening to and picked. And I don't mean this in like a douchey way by any means, but I don't listen to a lot of heavy music like outside of work.
I bet you don't, dude. You're immersed in it.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, it feels like work to me. So other than when I'm like learning a record, or like band sends me demos, or like, so I'll put it this way. The only stuff I really listen to on the heavy side are like records that people recommend to me, or like bands who I'm friends with put out new records,
right?
That sort of thing. I'm trying to think of like what I play when I'm at the gym, but even then it's more like Nine Inch Nails and like Meshuggah. Mm-hmm. Like that's like right. My go-to like gym jam.
Nine Inch Nails definitely has that pummeling industrial kind of awesome production quality, a lot of stars align in that band. So I could see that being a Jim track. Meshuggah too. Both of those are great for that.
Yeah, absolutely. So I wish I had a better answer as to what like new upcoming releases that I've been jamming, but
are there any ones that are outside of the metal world completely that you dig?
Honestly, no. Like, I don't listen to a lot of music. That's I'm sorry for such a lame answer, but
most producers say that.
Yeah, no, straight up, like I could recommend you a million comedy podcasts that I listen to.
Same here.
Yeah, as far as like heavy music or even just music, like it's hard for me to after a day of listening to music, get in my car and listen to music. If I'm going to the gym and I need music to like get me going, mm-hmm. it's stuff that's been out for years and whatever. Yeah. Like this band called Blindside, they had a song mm-hmm. on the movie Grind soundtrack.
Okay.
I've been listening to that. I've been listening to Snapcase. I don't know, like I'll usually revisit old, like Science by Incubus. I'll revisit old records when I'm at the gym.
I hear you.
And then but when like new bands put out records, I'll jam that as well, like bands that like Randy does usually, like Boundaries, Orthodox, like those, that sort of mm-hmm. stuff. New Thy Art record. It was like something that I was like jamming at the gym. So it's usually just like stuff that friends of mine put out. And then, you know, if somebody like recommends me something, I'll jam that. Like new Spirit Box EP was rad. Mm-hmm. For non-metal stuff, although it is kind of, there's this band called Three Teeth that I kind of like. It's like that dude Mick Gordon, who did like the Doom soundtrack, did a bunch of work with them. And it's more like on the industrial side.
Okay, cool.
Slightly reminiscent of Nine Inch Nails, and but yeah, that's really the gist of my music taste as of late.
Gotcha. What's up for 2024, man?
Oh man, couple things. I'm going to Australia in January with the Acacia Strain. That's with Dying Wish and Volatile Ways. And
wow.
Then I'm doing a record in February, and then in March. Acacia Strain's got some stuff lined up. Can't really say much about that right now.
Mm-hmm.
And then at some point, I will have a drum library, which is very exciting. We just finished that. Me and Kyle Brownlee of Counterparts and Soundblind Drums. We just did two libraries together, and that will be out at some point in 2024. So. Yeah, I'm sure there's a bunch of other stuff that I'm forgetting, but those are the main things that I'm looking forward to.
Well, Matt, it was fun talking to you, man. Good to catch up again, and looking forward to all these mini projects, recordings, and productions, and everything in between you got going on. So I'll keep my tabs on you, man.
Thank you, man. Yeah, you as well. It was fun chatting with you.
Absolutely, dude. We'll talk soon.
All right, will do, man.
That does it for this one. Thanks for tuning in, and thanks to Matt for talking about all the studio topics from tracking to producing and everything in between. Hope y'all enjoyed it, and as always, we'll catch you on the next one. Crash, bang, boom.